Welcome to ATS Mix.
I think until you start asking questions, you know, you're just going to buy whatever's offered to you on the 6 o'clock news.
ATS Mix.
This isn't a talk show, it's a freak show.
From AboveTopSecret.com.
I'd also be skeptical of the people who are out there selling conspiracy theories.
The Internet's most popular conspiracy theory discussion board. ATS Mix. From AboveTopSecret.com.
In the name of Christ, just let us in!
Starts now.
Well, Senor Rabbit, I don't know if you have had a chance to watch the Discovery Channel or the Travel Channel anytime recently. Have you had a chance to have your TV on?
Oh, yeah, ever since the Springer did his thing. I watch it all the time now.
Yeah, this whole last weekend I was watching, and they were running almost a marathon on Bigfoot. Did you happen to catch any of those episodes?
Yeah, I saw the thing on the Patterson-Gimlin film thing, which I remember seeing, you know, back when I was just getting ready to go to in the service. Back in 67, I think it was.
Really?
Yeah, that's when October 20th, 67 is when they originally did that film. And it may have been a year later when I was on leave that I actually first saw that clip on some kind of science show. Yeah, I was blown away by it. It was really amazing.
Well, I'm kind of curious, since you were there in Saigon with the first Termer 69 show, did you happen to hear over in those parts of the country anything that might have been similar to a Sasquatch or a Bigfoot? Do they have a legend or lore in that part of the area that you may have heard of?
Boy, if they do, Johnny, I don't recall it. But, you know, I do remember that there was troops that were out in the fields doing search and destroy missions and stuff like that that said that they came across some weird stuff that they couldn't really, not necessarily identify, but encounters that they... It's one of those things, you know, like the guys, the pilots and the UFOs and stuff, they'd always say, well, I don't want to make a report. It was kind of that kind of stuff. So, you know, I wasn't there. You know, it's like 15th generation conversation. Who knows? But I'm sure you're dealing in an Amazon kind of environment. I'm sure that there's all kinds of weird stuff out there in the jungles and, you know, that people have never seen before.
Anyway, we sent out, you know, feelers to try to get a number of researchers on the Bigfoot phenomena to come forward to sit with us in a round table setting.
Right.
And out of the 12 that we sent out, I ended up getting two replies. One was by a young lady by the name of Autumn Williams, who I believe has a Bigfoot society in, it's the OregonBigfoot.com area. And unfortunately, she's got herself a teething 10-month-old who's just become mobile and requires every bit of her waking moment. And I'm quoting her as what she just said. So she had to bow out. But one of the folks that did agree to come on with us is from the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Society.com. In fact, we'd like to ask our listeners, if they would, you can punch up in your browser as you're listening to this at www.pabigfootsociety.com. And PA obviously is the abbreviation, I'm assuming, for Pennsylvania. So it's the pabigfootsociety.com. PA Bigfoot Society, one word. His name is Eric Altman. Let me give you just a little background on Eric. He's 37 years old and he hails from Greensburg, Pennsylvania. His interest in the Bigfoot phenomenon began at the age of 10. His field research started in 97. He is a former member of the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization and belongs, of course, to several Bigfoot and paranormal research organizations. In 1998, Eric joined the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Society, and in 2000, he became the director. It's a volunteer research organization made up of various men and women of various backgrounds and interests, but they all have one common denominator, that being Bigfoot. So at this time, if you would, it's Eric Altman. Hi, Eric. How are you tonight?
Hey, good evening, guys. How are you?
We're great, Eric. Thanks so much for staying up with us for the ATS Mix show. Johnny and I are both very blown away when we started doing the research and put the thread up on the site about Bigfoot. And in fact, if you don't mind, Eric, we're going to go right into some of the questions, and then we want to go into some generalities with you. First off, how long ago was it, Eric, that you first became excited about the concept? Did you physically see a Sasquatch?
No, I've never seen a creature. I've had some very unusual experiences in the woods while doing research, but I've never seen a creature to stay in my mind they actually exist.
Okay. So
I've been doing this since 10, so it's been, 27 years. And most of it's been book research and documentation research through newspapers, magazines, stuff like that, television shows, movies. That's where I pretty much got my start in the subject.
But there had to be something that got you gung-ho about it, though, right? To even get you researching that.
I was going to ask the same thing.
It was a movie that I saw back in the 1970s. I'm sure you guys are familiar with it, called Legend of Boggy Creek.
Yes.
It's a docudrama that takes place in Falk, Arkansas, and it's based on sighting reports of folks that lived in that area that were seeing a bipedal creature that was supposedly haunting and terrorizing the townsfolk of Falk. And this movie was basically a dramatization based on their sightings. And about 10 years old, we were playing on a local channel in the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area, and I happened to catch it on a Sunday afternoon after church, and that pretty much got me hooked. And I just started watching anything I could on TV, reading any kind of newspaper articles, magazine articles, anything I could get my hands on.
You said your interest started when you were 10 years old, correct?
Correct.
All right. And now here you are 36-something, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, you obviously are a single guy, aren't you? I mean, to have pursuits like this?
No, I'm married.
No kidding.
Married just past our 10-year wedding anniversary in September, and we have a 13-year-old son.
Okay, well, now, obviously, if from the age 10, and here you are 36, and you've had this interest in Bigfoot, and you were married, I guess, if you just spent your 10th-year anniversary, how does your wife feel about your researching this unknown creature that a lot of people call Sasquatch or Bigfoot?
Well, I didn't tell her before we got married.
Yeah.
Actually, while we were engaged, I told her about it. And she's okay with it. As long as I don't devote too much time to it, and, you know, I try to divide my time between my research and studies and spending time with her and our son and making sure that, you know, I have my priorities straight as far as what comes first. She's okay with it.
Right.
As a matter of fact, she's the secretary of our organization. She kind of helps with organize things and keep things running. Now, she doesn't necessarily believe that Bigfoot exists. She's kind of on the fence about it. But she supports me, and she stands behind me on my research. She lets me do it, so it's pretty cool.
And how old is your son?
Our son's 13. We just adopted him last year.
Oh, fantastic. Good for you.
Congratulations, man.
And what is his thoughts on what Daddy does?
Well, at first, he didn't really know how to take it, but showed him some things on TV, some documentaries, and I talked to him about it, and he showed an interest in it. He's gone out on a couple investigations with me and a couple hikes, and he's really gotten into it in these last couple of months. Really shown an interest in it, and anytime I go on an investigation or out on a Bigfoot hike, as we call it, he wants to go with us, so kind of cool, kind of like a father-son bonding thing.
Okay, hey, Eric, our website, you know, when we query the membership to jump on board, we have a pretty intelligent group of people, and I think you're going to be interested in some of the questions, and you'll be surprised how many people have the same beliefs that all of us do, that, you know, there's things in the world that can't be explained, and you know, but we still are going to, you know, search until we can find answers. This is by ATS member Hinky, and I think it's a female, but I'm not sure. It says, all the sightings around the country, even different names for the creature in different countries, it's a worldwide phenomenon, obviously. Researchers differing experiences across the planet in search of the creature. She has a couple of questions, and I'm going to put them all together if I can. First off, Eric, why do we not have any real physical proof, such as hair or animal faces, that Bigfoot exists?
Well, actually, we do. There have been several hair samples collected and turned in for scientific analysis. There is a retired primatologist named Dr. Henner Fehrenbach out of Oregon, Washington area, and if I'm not mistaken, he used to run or head up a primatology institute out there. And Dr. Fehrenbach specializes in the study of primates, and several hair samples have been collected and sent to him, and he's analyzed these through micron telescope and matching these hair samples with other known species. And if I'm remembering correctly, he has 5 or 6 examples in his collection that cannot be positively identified or matched with any known species that he feels are genuine Sasquatch hare. We have collected feces, not necessarily our organization, but other organizations have collected feces. And there's a lot you can tell from fecal samples, diet. You can learn a lot about what kind of parasites are living in the intestines of these creatures.
Right.
You know, so hard evidence has been collected. We've collected hundreds, if not thousands, of footprint casts over the years, different organizations. And some of those actually show dermal ridges on these footprint casts. And what dermal ridges are, for those who aren't familiar, is everybody has fingerprints on your hands and feet. Or I should say fingerprints, but you have ridges on your hands called fingerprints, and they're also on your feet.
Right.
Very, very well-known forensic, formerly a forensic specialist. I think he's still working, but he lives in Conroe, Texas. His name is Jimmy Chilcott. He works for a police department down there, and he's one of his hobbies is to collect fingerprints and dermal samples from primates from all around the world. And what he's done is he has the largest collection of these dermal ridge samples from fingerprinting or ink printing these primates. And he studied some of these casts that have these dermal ridges in, and he believes they do not belong to any known primate or a human being. So we do have the casts that show the dermal ridges in them. Hair samples have been studied, and there are several that have not been able to be positively identified or matched with a known mammal species or primate species. And the fecal matter has been studied, unfortunately, as far as I'm aware of, no conclusive evidence has come from the fecal studies, but there is hard evidence, and it is slowly mounting. We're slowly collecting it, but unfortunately, at this time, it's not enough to prove that this animal does exist. Science wants a body or a part of a body to study.
Sure, and speaking of such, this same member asked this, forget the fact that bear, deer, other large animal skeletons are found in the wild. It seems that Mr. Bigfoot does something with his or her dead. Apparently the bodies aren't buried or burned, but no remains seem to have been found. But why is that?
Well, there's several theories on that, and to be perfectly honest with you, we don't really have an answer as to what happens to the bodies. Some Bigfoot researchers theorize that when an animal dies, they're like an elephant. They go to an elephant burial ground in the remote wilderness, and they die, and those areas haven't been discovered yet. Some theorize that these animals are intelligent enough to bury their own.
Right.
Some theorize that when an animal, and this is true of nature, when an animal dies, Mother Nature has a tremendous decomposition cycle or recycling system set up where these animals decompose very quickly. Small rodents, insects, other small animals, porcupines, they devour these bodies and they disappear very quickly.
Right.
It's very rare that you do find the remains of a dead bear in the woods or a dead deer. Yes, you find a dead deer that's been shot by hunters, but it's very rare that you find one that's died of natural causes. They decompose very quickly and they're gone. They don't linger on for years and years and years. So once an animal dies in the wild of natural causes, or even if it is killed, they're gone within a matter of weeks. And unfortunately, being that there are such a low number of these animals, they're theorized that there's a low number of these animals, it's like trying to find a needle in a haystack. You don't know where they're going to die. And even if you are out there, unless you're a scientist or you have some kind of scientific background, a wildlife biology degree or an anthropological degree, a primatology degree, and you find a bone in the woods, you may not necessarily be able to positively identify that bone. So you may pass it off as a bear or a deer or a common known animal. So there's various reasons why the bodies haven't been discovered in the wild yet. And not only that, we don't have many researchers out there currently looking.
Right.
There's a very small field of researchers out there who are actually looking for this creature. It is growing thanks to the internet, but it's not like your typical scientific field where you have scientists actually doing full-blown studies that are funded and to have the proper equipment to do it. So,
sure.
There's a lot of different reasons.
And, right.
You know, you can take your pick of which one you want, but there's a lot to really to look at.
And here's the questions. There's three of them from our member Antar. Antar's first question is, and there were several people, Eric, that made allusions to this particular first question, and that is, what are the possibilities that Bigfoot is actually an dimensional traveler?
That's a really hard question to answer, because at this point we really don't have an answer as to what Bigfoot is. The creature that we're researching leaves physical evidence. It leaves footprints. It leaves fecal samples that can be collected and studied, hair samples that can be collected. As I explained earlier, Henner Fehrenbach has five that he believes are legitimate samples. I personally believe this animal is a flesh and blood animal. It's a primate that has yet to be discovered.
Right.
There are people in the field that, as wacky as it may seem, believe that this creature is an extraterrestrial or is from another dimension.
Right.
And that's their prerogative to do so. And if you really take a look at the whole phenomenon, you know, some of what they talk about does make sense, because we really don't have a body at this point, and we can't answer a lot of the physical scientific questions at this point because we don't have the solid evidence to do so. So people seeing this information and why we don't have a body and why we don't have one captured once killed after all these years kind of reach out to these, well, let's answer a mystery with another mystery. Let's try to solve this with it being something that we can't solve it with.
Right.
And that's fine. That's their prerogative to do so. I personally feel that this creature is an animal. It just hasn't been categorized or cataloged yet. There are people on the fringe that feel it's an extraterrestrial or an alien or something from another dimension. And I don't dispute them. I mean, they're welcome to their opinion, but right. My opinion is it's an actual animal.
Okay, well, part two, in prefacing his part two, I read on the website that is, I think it's unmuseum.mus.pa. Is that you guys? .us? It's talking about Bigfoot of North America, Eric. And I found something extremely interesting on this website, and it leads me into his question, but this website says that the very first sighting of Bigfoot or Sasquatch by a white man apparently came in 1811 near what is now the town of Jasper, Alberta, Canada, by a trader named David Thompson, who found strange footprints 14 inches long, 8 inches wide, with four toes in the snow, etc. And so Antar's question is, if you were to come in contact with one of these creatures, would you shoot if they were coming towards you in a seemingly threatening manner, or would you try to avoid them or it as you would a grizzly bear?
That's another good question. It's very difficult to answer because the tendencies of this animal, based on sighting reports that we get and the other researchers get, that these animals are usually very docile and shy, more of a curious type of animal that rarely show any threatening behavior. It is an animal, like I feel it is an animal, so any animal that if you encroach on its habitat or you encroach on its food sources or it feels threatened or it's protecting its young, certainly can become defensive. So I treat it with a great amount of respect and treat it like an animal as such, and I'm very cautious when it comes to this animal. However, if there was an animal approaching me, regardless if it was a grizzly bear or a Bigfoot, it was approaching me in a very aggressive manner, I wouldn't hesitate to defend myself and shoot it. I would prefer not to, but if my life is in jeopardy or I feel threatened or in danger, I'm certainly going to defend myself, and then if I have to shoot one, I'll shoot one. But I would prefer not to if that were the case.
Okay, and the last question from Antar is, what is the your best Native American story that you have ever heard about Bigfoot or Sasquatch?
Well, there's so many that I could relay, but here in the Keystone State of Pennsylvania, I'll share one very briefly with you. There's a legend about the Susquehannock Indians, and over near the York, Pennsylvania, Lancaster, Philadelphia area, along the Susquehannock River, there is a legend about these 4-foot-tall, hair-covered creatures called Albert Witches. And these Albert Witches would hide up in trees, and people would come to this location called Chickie's Rock, which is located in the Susquehannock, just outside of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And they would picnic and go out in the woods and, on little dates and whatnot. This is back in the early settlers' days. And these Albert Witch creatures that were 4 foot tall would hide up in the trees and throw apples down at the picnickers to scare them off. And once the picnickers left the area, the creatures would come down out of the trees and take their picnics, their lunches, or whatever they packed. and take them back up in the trees and eat them. So that's one of my favorite little stories here, Native American legends here from Pennsylvania. But there are others. There's tons of them. The Native Americans have hundreds of names for these creatures, and they actually have towns and cities and villages in the Pacific Northwest that are named after these creatures.
Wow.
That's interesting. We have another member here who had a few questions here, and I'll try to summarize them all. This is by Elaine. Elaine says, I've always wanted to know if any researcher has any idea of the possible lifespan of a Bigfoot. Of course, I know there's not much physical evidence of Bigfoot, but if a researcher has some kind of idea about how old these creatures might live to be, would it be comparable or comparable to a large primate's lifespan?
Well, I had an interesting conversation with a very good friend of mine. He's a wildlife biologist. This past weekend, we were discussing the lifespan of creatures, and we were theorizing that it's very possible that their lifespans are comparable to that of a mountain gorilla or a large primate. We really don't know how long these animals live because we haven't been able to study them and to really kind of determine, you know, what their lifespan is. We were talking about the famous Patterson-Gimlin movie and the Patty creature, and we were wondering if she was still around today, even though the film took place in 1967, would she still be alive today 40 years later?
Right.
We really don't know what their lifespan is. We can speculate, and that's based on information we have about known primates, but it's purely speculation. Matter of fact, we got into a good debate about speculation based on, you know, primates and this creature based on what we theorize. So it's all conjecture. It's all theories. And unfortunately, until we have one in captivity to actually study or be able to study one in its natural habitat, we really can't give a definitive answer. We can only theorize and speculate and base that on, you know, current things that we do know, current knowledge that we do have.
Well, you know, actually, this question kind of fascinates me because, as we all know, humans, we have a tendency as we grow old, our hair will turn gray. And with other certain animals, such as like a dog or a cat, their hair color will change. Do you or have you heard of any cases of Bigfoot or Sasquatch to where perhaps as they are maturing in age that the colorization of their fur or hair might change? And this is me asking. This isn't a member asking.
There have been several cases documented over the years where people claim to have seen various colored creatures, from black, brown, reddish brown, gray, even white colored creatures. Now, it has yet to be determined if these creatures are actually albino creatures or if, in fact, these are elderly creatures or creatures that are aging where their hair has turned. It's gray to, you know, as they've gotten older. Again, we really don't have an honest answer to give because we haven't been able to study these, but based on what we know of other animals, humans, primates, and how their hairs tend to change as they get older, it's very possible that these Bigfoot creatures do.
Sure.
Like I said, there's been cases of many well-documented cases in the Ohio area of white-colored creatures. Even here in eastern or western Pennsylvania, there's been sighting reports of a white or a grayish-colored creature, you know, being seen. And that very well might be the case where it's an elderly creature, an older creature. Until we have one to study in its own habitat, I really can't answer that with a certainty, but we can speculate that, you know, that may be the case. And I would tend to think, you know, that if these are along the same lines as humans and primates, that if the creatures get older, yes, their hair is going to change color.
Yeah, all right, may I do a minor sidebar, Eric, on this before I go into X-Files question with you?
Sure.
And it brings to mind something I had read on one of the sites talking about the legend of the Abominable Snowman. Now, is the Abominable Snowman, is it supposed to be a Bigfoot, quote-unquote, Sasquatch, but in the, like, the snow area?
Yes, basically. The creature they're reporting is very similar in description. From the account that I've read and studied, it is a little more aggressive than your typical California Bigfoot or Pacific Northwest Bigfoot. But the description of the creature is very, basically the same. And I don't feel there's a subspecies of these creatures. I don't feel there's different genetic species of these creatures. I feel they're all the same creature, but they've evolved due to their habitat and their
right.
geological areas.
Yeah, the climate, right.
Sure.
Right. creatures are going to evolve differently as humans evolve differently because of the climate they grow up in. You know, they're going to have darker skin or lighter skin, or you know, based on the climate they live in, based on the region they live in, based on a lot of factors.
Right.
So, I do believe that the creature in the Himalayas and Nepal, Tibet, that's being described is the same creature. It just has genetic differences based on its geographic location and climate.
All right. Let's get into X-Files question. It's really a very short question. It says, with the advance in technology, like motion detectors and heat-sensitive radar, and, of course, all the satellite tracking secretive stuff that everybody has, all the governments have, why hasn't there been any verifiable evidence come forth, Eric, on this?
Well, I think... that's a really good question, too. I think our government is aware of or has the opportunity to discover these creatures. You know, we do have the technology to do so. It is becoming more available to the public. We have a new program out called Google Maps, which allows you to basically see street level using satellites.
Sure.
And this technology is becoming more available to the public to use, and for researchers like myself, that might be a very invaluable tool for us eventually down the road. I don't see any reason why our government would have any interest in these creatures, and if they have discovered them, they probably discount it or write it off. It wouldn't surprise me if they knew about it, not at all, but I don't think there's any real reason for them to study these animals. So if they come across something like this with one of their radars or one of their satellites or anything to that effect, they're just going to write it off as, you know, just another case that they're not going to be able to, you know, follow up on or really want to follow up on, and leave it as such.
Right.
I've talked to other researchers in the past who've told me, yeah, the government knows about this. They've talked to people in high-ranking authorities in the government, and they have proof on it, but they really just don't follow up on it. Whether or not that's true, I haven't seen it for myself, so I can't honestly say if our government does know. But I would tend to think, you know, they've got more important things to worry about. They're worried about terrorism, and they're worried about global warming, you know, more serious problems to worry about than Bigfoot or UFOs or anything like that.
Yeah, they've got enough of those in D.C., huh?
Yeah.
Well, before I get into my question here from Enjoys05, I want to do a quick little sidebar on what you guys were just talking about. Do you think that our Bigfoot researchers that are actually going out into the field trying to find our elusive creature is utilizing this technology? I mean, it's available to the public. Do you think that they are able to use this to their benefit also?
Some organizations, yes, that can afford it. The technology that's available, the very high-tech technology like the infrared cameras and the heat-sensitive thermal cameras, they're extremely expensive. Some go as far as $10,000, $25,000 for some of these handheld and portable devices. Bigfoot research is privately funded by the individuals who do it. We're not publicly funded. We're not funded by large corporate sponsors. Very difficult to get any kind of corporate sponsorship when a lot of people don't buy into this. So
right.
A lot of it comes out of our own pockets. And there are some organizations that have had private sponsorship or private funding where they can actually afford to buy these high-tech pieces of equipment. I know our group, we rely heavily on membership dues to pay for our equipment, and we've gone out and spent the money wisely on equipment that we can afford. We do have a thermal camera that looks like basically your typical VHS camera that would sit on your shoulder. We have a thermal camera one of our members has that is donated to the group, and we've got parabolic microphones, we've got night vision equipment, we've got game trail cameras, digital game trail cameras to use, and this has all been purchased by our group, by our members. A lot of groups, you know, that are smaller groups really can't afford to buy some of this stuff, so they buy what they can, digital 35mm cameras, a Sony Nightshot camera, you know, they buy what they can afford to use. Some of the larger groups like the Bigfoot Field Research Organization may have private funding, and they're able to afford some of this equipment. And it is helping these groups that do have this equipment. They're bringing forward some rather interesting evidence, and some of it's still, you know, to be determined what it is, but they're actually getting things now. And I think the more it becomes available to us and the less costly it is, more groups are going to be able to purchase this equipment and utilize it and show some good benefits from it.
Well, let's hope that they can. And I'll go ahead and ask this question from one of our members by the name of Enjoys05. This member asks, do you ever feel that you are wasting your time looking for something that just may not even exist? And if so, what keeps you wanting to find one or to learn more about them?
Yeah, there are times where I get discouraged, and there have been times where I felt like I've wasted a lot of years looking for this thing. But to be honest with you, the majority of times we go out in the woods to look, we come back empty-handed. And that's quite often. I would say of the 100% we go out, maybe 90% we come back with very little, if anything. It's that 10% that we find something, a footprint, or we have an experience, or we get a really good report with a good, credible witness where we find something that may determine or may present a creature in the area. That's what keeps us motivated and keeps us going. There are things out there. If you seriously look into the subject and you spend some time doing the legwork and doing the field research, you're going to start to see things. You're going to start to find things. If you sit at home and watch TV and listen to radio shows and get online and read about this stuff, you're never going to find it for yourself. So I encourage anybody that's interested to get out there and look. Yes, it is discouraging at times, but if you keep pushing forward, eventually you're going to find something that makes it all worthwhile.
All right, I'm going to go in a kind of a different direction here, if you don't mind, Eric. We have a member by the name of Cray Wolf. It's C-R-E-E-W-O-L-F. If you have a semi-intelligent primate that has managed to elude mankind for generations, whose existence can only be confirmed with a few fuzzy photographs, fuzzy film clips, and generations of legends told by American Indians, Sherpas, and other cultures, what would you do with the evidence which directly proves the existence of these creatures, especially if you intended to protect it from harassment, from being hunted to extinction, from being subjected to scientific experiments that would bring up questions about the morality of doing so, as well as questioning the social implications of discovering a species of primate which displays intelligence and sustenance? Could this be one thing the modern scientific community is doing right? Protecting such a creature from ourselves.
I don't think there's a private or public organization that's done that yet. The media is very, very good at finding these sorts of things out, and we would know about it by now. I don't think there's anybody out there that specifically does this to keep the creature's identities and whereabouts, location, existence from being resolved. I don't think that's the case. Our overall goal has been, and mine's changed a little bit over the years, but our overall goal has been to document enough scientific evidence to collect it, to prove these animals actually do exist. And yes, we may have to sacrifice one or two of these creatures and have the testing done and have the studies done on a creature or a body, but eventually get them on an endangered species so they are protected. There are two ordinances in the United States, and I believe both are in Washington. One's in Washington, and I believe the other's in Bellingham, where they're protecting these creatures, that there's a law against going out there and hunting them. Skamania County and what was the other county? Whatcom County, I'm sorry. Where these creatures are protected. Under law, you can be penalized and serve time in jail and pay a stiff financial penalty if you kill one of these things. I don't think there's any organization out there that's specifically out there preventing these creatures from being discovered. If there is, then I'm totally naive to it and I'm completely unaware that they exist. Our group is specifically designed to keep these creatures from becoming extinct. And unfortunately, they come down to the point of having one of these animals gone through all these scientific tests and studies, which science is going to do regardless. But if it means sacrificing one of these animals to protect the rest of the species, that's what needs to be done.
Right.
That actually kind of brings up an interesting scenario there, Eric, because I'm sure there would be some that would maybe question if there might possibly be a morality issue here. With a possible captured creature being dissected in the name of science.
I'm sure there are groups out there that would be against capturing one of these creatures or having a scientific test done on them. I mean, there are well-known organizations out there today that are very much against the cruelty of animals and towards animals and And that's fine. They have that right to do so. But in order to protect the entire species, like I stated, you know, there are going to have to be tests done, and it's going to have to be studied so we have a better understanding of this animal. I mean, you can't just capture one of these creatures and say, okay, they exist, see you later, and let it go. We have to learn about what it's eating. So if it's eating a certain kind of diet, plant or animal or whatever, and we're destroying that, you know, and if it's on an endangered species, we have to protect its habitat.
You know, sure.
We need to learn about this animal. We need to understand what it does, why it does it, what it eats, why it eats what it eats. We need to learn as much as we can. So unfortunately, these groups might get angry that we have one or two of these creatures in captivity and it's being studied or dissected or whatever the case may be. But if it's for the overall benefit of the entire species, it has to be done. And sure, there's going to be people up in arms, and there's going to be those who cry and complain and, you know, get upset about it, and they have that prerogative to do so. But they're not looking at the entire picture. We need to learn about these animals as much as we can to protect the entire race. If we just lock one of these things up in a cage for a few days and look at it and say, oh, how cute, let's let it go because we don't want to hurt it, we're basically not protecting the race. We're letting that creature go because we feel bad for it. And that's going to end up, you know, ultimately maybe down the road, you know, end up wiping out the species because we didn't take the time to study that, to learn what it needs to eat, learn, you know, where it lives and why it does the things it does so we can keep it protected.
You had mentioned earlier that there had been some evidence found of hair and also some fecal matter, if I recall correctly. In the research into the fecal matter, were we able to find out at all, perhaps, what kind of diet these creatures actually do have?
I can't honestly answer that question because I haven't done a lot of research on the fecal studies as far as, you know, what they determine from what they've learned from this.
Sure.
I do know, based on citing reports, that this animal could be considered an omnivore. It's very opportunistic. It will eat whatever it can. There's been reports of it eating or seen eating or hunting deer, eating plants and berries, nuts, fauna, fish, salmon. It loves salmon, small animals, rodents. It's a very opportunistic animal, and whatever it can eat, it will eat. And I think that's based on where it's at, what food sources are available. There's been thousands of reports talking about this animal seen eating different things. And I think it's very much like a bear, where it's an omnivore. It eats whatever it can eat.
Okay, let's get into more of a lighter view of Bigfoot, if we can. And that's the 1987 movie, Harry and the Hendersons, that was produced by William Dare and starred John Lithgow, Melinda Dillon, and Don Ameche. And, you know, basically the whole story, obviously, it was about a Bigfoot creature that the family finds and, you know, becomes close to and friends with and tries to domesticate, if you will. Don't you think that film, in a lot of respects, Eric, really brought more interest in 1987 when it was released to The Legend of Bigfoot?
It did some aspects, I think. And the reason being is you know, it brought it more into the public forefront. You know, everybody saw it as Bigfoot is a fun, lovable creature. It was a family-made movie, you know, and they brought it out in the public. Really gave it some emphasis and showed everybody that Bigfoot is not a big, nasty, hairy creature that's going to rip you apart.
Right.
Actually, it has a personality and feelings, and it's a feel-good movie, let's be honest. I have a copy of it in my Bigfoot collection. It's
one of my favorite. So do I. Movies. Guilty.
So do I, yeah.
Guilty. It's just a fun movie, but I think it really put the whole Bigfoot phenomenon in the public eye, so to speak, because here's a mainstream movie with Don Ameche and John Lithgow, and you know, it really put it out there. It's a, here you go. There's Bigfoot.
Right.
They had fun with it. It's a very fun movie, and people saw that, and they could relate to that.
And we're talking about 20 years ago. That's hard to believe, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's still today, it's one of the best costumes out there I've seen. I've seen a lot of crappy Bigfoot movies and documentaries, and it's one of the best Bigfoot costumes I've seen to date.
One of my favorite scenes out of that movie is when Harry, I guess, finally sees all the animal trophies that Mr. Henderson, that John Lithgow has, and he goes out to bury them. And I thought that was just hilarious. That cracked me. And the look that he shot John Lithgow at the time, and Lithgow's face just kind of, you know, oh boy. I wanted to tell you a little something here, and I don't think I've shared this with Dave, but I have a number of mining claims that are located up along the Klamath River on the California side, just about 4 miles from the Oregon-California border, if you can call it that.
I'll be there this weekend.
A majority of them are around Happy Camp, which, of course,
I was there too.
Yeah, where, of course, a number of sightings. In fact, if I recall correctly, the first publicized sightings that made the news, I believe, was from around the Happy Camp area. But anyway, getting into my little story. Every year, I go up there because I have to maintain them if I want to hold on to them. And I'll make this very brief. There was one episode that I had with an event that I am not able to explain. And we were up in a very remote part there in the Trinity Mountains. And we were on a creek that seemed to have a clearing. And my partner and I, who were getting ready to do some mining, had a late night of getting up there. And so we were real late in setting things up. And so a lot of our stuff was still not even put up, but we just went ahead and made our tent. Well, during the period of our making our tent and everything, my partner kept saying, "Do you smell that?" He goes, "Boy, that smells like a skunk." He says, that just smells terrible, doesn't it? That smells so bad." And I did smell something, but I didn't think it was as bad as what he thought it was. Around 2:30, 3 o'clock at night, I started hearing, I was awakened by hearing some heavy brush being broken, but it sounded like it was like almost all over the place. I woke up my buddy, and of course the smell again was there. Then there seemed to be a number of things happening around us that I wasn't able to explain, which appeared to be a number of rocks being tossed towards our way. And after doing a little research, I came, now once again, I don't know what happened, but from my research that I found that this may be actually something that the creatures that we are calling Sasquatch and Bigfoot sometimes may do, and it might be territorial. Is that correct?
Yes, there are, and actually what you've described is very typical of what people report to us, and not just us, but every other organization. And on a little sidebar, if I could jump off for a quick second, I just came from Happy Camp this past week, and I was up there along the Klamath River and Bluff Creek, Willow Creek, the Hoopa Valley. Beautiful country.
Absolutely. It's beautiful.
Sure is. But getting back to your question, yes, it is very commonly reported where, you know, people go out and they camp, or they're out in a remote wilderness area, and they have the smell and the brush breaking, and then rocks are thrown at them. And my personal opinion is it's a kind of a fear factor type thing where they want to try to discourage you or scare you off from their area.
Right.
They're not purposely throwing that at you to hit you. They just don't want you in their territory. You know,
yeah.
They're warning you, hey, this is our turf. You're in our turf. We're going to try to dissuade you. Or and somebody else this weekend I was talking to up in Willow Creek told me that it very well might be a playful aspect. Or they're trying to get you to communicate with them. You know, they're throwing the rocks at you to get your attention, hoping that you'll throw the rocks back, and, you know, kind of like a playful communication thing.
Yeah.
I really don't know.
Harry, throw me the rock!
Yeah, the downside in my story is that several of these rocks were getting, and they were quite large, too. If they had hit any one of us, they would have caused tremendous damage. In fact, it did end up pretty much destroying at least one of these rocks, which appeared to be about 25, 30 pounds big, destroying our Coleman stove that apparently was in the pathway of their being tossed. End of my story is we didn't wait around the following day. We went ahead and packed, and we got the hell out of there.
Big chicken.
And we didn't sleep very well that night either.
Well, if it's any comfort, as far as I know, and I've been doing this for 20, 25, 26, 20, I lost track how many years I've been doing this.
Right.
I do not know of any cases where Bigfoot has purposely hit somebody with a rock.
Well, that's because they're not around to be able to say so.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Poor Fred.
Many cases where they've thrown the rocks and they've come really close, but no one I've ever talked to has actually been hit by a rock. So.
Well,
they're still out there.
Well, you know what's amazing? Both of you are going to find this really amazing. 40 years ago, almost to the day, today, 40 years ago is when the Patterson-Gimlin film was done on October 20th. Of course, this is the 24th. 40 years ago, Roger Patterson and Roger Gimlin claimed the film that they did of the famous Bigfoot recording. Those of us that have become Google people, and I never was one. Johnny got me Googling. Once I Googled myself, I just can't stop Googling now. But I want to, Eric, I want to read just this one little short excerpt. This is from the Wikipedia shortcut when you Google Bigfoot. And it's talking about these two gentlemen, Roger Patterson and Robert Gimlin. And it says, the film has been subjected to many attempts both to debunk and authenticate the film. Some people have declared the film a hoax with a man in an ape suit, but others say the film depicts a genuine unknown creature. Now, Patterson, Roger Patterson, died in 1972 of cancer. Robert Gimlin is alive and has recently begun making appearances at Bigfoot conferences around the world. Previously, he had kept out of the public eye, and he had little contact with those who believed that Bigfoot was a real entity. Both men dismissed allegations that they had ever faked the film, and Patterson was firm in his assistance that they had encountered and filmed an animal unknown to science. Gimlin, too, maintains he did not falsify the film, but in the 1999 telephone interview and television producer Chris Packham, he said that for some time he was totally convinced that no one could fool him. And of course, even though he is older now, has said that he thinks there could have been the possibility of a hoax, but it would have to have been a really well-planned out, off-the-chart hoax if Roger Patterson had set it up. What, you know, and obviously you've seen the film, you've seen all kinds of things over your period of over 20 years, Eric. I mean, when you see things like this original film of 40 years ago, I mean, what was your initial thought when you saw this? Did you believe? Were you skeptical? What was your feelings about it?
When I first saw this film, I was very, very young, probably 11 or 12 years old. Back in 1981, 80. And my first thought was, wow. That's all I could say is,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah, mine too. Yeah,
really. I mean, it was just like seeing something out of the prehistoric past come to life. You know, they filmed an unknown primate, a Neanderthal, a missing link, whatever you want to call it. And to me, that was, at the time, one of the biggest thrills to see this movie, this film. And
right.
I watched it hundreds and hundreds of times,
yeah,
over
same
like
here.
Mm-hmm. 5 years. Was it faked? Very possibly, well, could have been. There's been a man come forward who claims he was in the suit, and there's been a book written on the allegations that the film was fake. Roger unfortunately passed away, and he went to his grave insisting that this was the real deal. His wife has made some money off of it. Roger didn't make a little bit of money off of it. He didn't become wealthy off of it. Bob's still alive. Matter of fact, we were just in Willow Creek celebrating the 40th anniversary this past weekend.
Right.
The time in Bluff Creek. Robert has, to this day, denied any involvement in the film being a hoax. He still
right.
does. His story has not changed. Yes, I am familiar with the article you're talking about where he felt, for the longest time, he could not have been fooled, and he says he may have been subject to a hoax, but I don't feel that Bob was part of, if it was a hoax, Bob was part of it. I feel that he was there, and if it was a hoax, he was not involved. He was just a witness to it.
Right.
I don't think, in my opinion, this film is a hoax. People have studied this film for many, many years, and the original films, there's still two or three in existence, the original copies, but if you study them, and M.K. Davis has done some phenomenal work with digitizing the film and doing some enhancements on it, you can see muscles moving. You can see the way the creature flows, the arm length. There's so many things in this film that really lean the creature to being a creature, not a man in a suit. There's just too much to it. And yes, this man came forward named Bob Hieronymus, who claimed he was in the suit, and there was a book written to try to discredit Patterson. you know, it's speculation.
Right.
Unfortunately, sure. You know, there's always going to be people coming forward, and there have been people coming forward saying, I was the guy in the suit. I did this. I did that. No one's ever been able to recreate the exact footage the way it happened, and I don't think anybody ever will. I think what you see in that film is a Bigfoot creature.
Right.
Unfortunately, after that film was shot, my friend and I were discussing this. There hasn't been any other sightings of that creature since, nor proof that it's been around that area. So we don't know. And I don't think we'll ever really know the honest truth. We can debate it all night long. Was it real? Was it fake? I don't think we'll ever have a full answer to it. But there's arguments for both sides.
Right.
Sure. We're getting actually pretty close here to the point where we're going to have to wrap this up, Eric. But before we do, I would like to ask your personal opinion. Of course, we want to remind our listeners and members alike to visit your website, which is at www.pabigfootsociety.com. In your opinion, or if you had any advice for somebody that possibly wanted to get into locating, photographing, physically get involved in the research out in the field, what advice and what items would you tell them to take with them so that they would be perhaps better prepared out in the field?
Well, the first thing I would offer advice to anybody that wants to go looking for one of these creatures is to prepare yourself. And what I mean by preparing yourself is to educate yourself on the animal, educate yourself on wildlife, educate yourself on survival skills, nature. Learn as much as you can about the wilderness, the outdoors, and about this creature. Educate yourself before you go out just running out into the woods looking for one of these things. Because, unfortunately, Mother Nature is so unpredictable, and somebody going out there without any knowledge can end up seriously injured, dead, and I don't want to see that happening. So the first thing I always suggest is anybody that wants to get involved in this is before you just go running out into the woods and camouflage with a shotgun or a camera, educate yourself. Learn as much as you can about the creature. Learn as much as you can about Mother Nature, forest, other wild animals, weather, survival skills. Educate yourself so you're prepared. Once you get out there, the best tools that I can offer advice as far as taking out in the field are a good camera, a good audio recording device, good clothing, comfortable shoes, well-protected shoes, I should say, something, you know, that, like boots that have to tread on it, keep your feet warm, and just use common sense. There are people that go out there thinking they know it all and accomplish whatever they want to do, but just going out there and doing it, they're sadly mistaken, and they can end up seriously hurt or injured, and I hate to see anybody do that. So prepare yourself before you go out. Research as much as you can. I did it for many, many years before I started doing field research and trying to educate myself. And even to this day, I still educate myself as much as I can. I learn from my elders who have been in the field years before me. I associate myself with people in the scientific community and try to learn as much as I can from them, although sometimes I don't agree with them. We still try to... still try to learn as much as we can from them, you know.
And sure.
That's what I try to tell people to do, you know, educate yourself, get yourself a good, well-balanced knowledge of everything before you go out, and then go.
I want to throw my 2 cents worth in there, which is make sure that you at least tell somebody where you're going to be in, approximately what part of the remote area you're going to be in, possibly even notify forest rangers or somebody in authority other than your family and family members and friends too, just to, you know, just as a backup.
Certainly. And a very well-known researcher by the name of Robert W. Morgan suggested to me a long time ago that if you're going to go out into an area that you're concerned your safety might be at risk or in danger, leave a map to where you're going in your glove box in your car. That way, if they find your car, they can follow this map to where you're going to be.
Boy, that's fantastic. A good tip.
That's a great tip. Eric, we want to thank you once again for joining us at this late hour, being there on the East Coast. We appreciate you staying up this late with us. We want to remind our members and listeners again that the website is www.pabigfootsociety.com. PA Bigfoot Society being one word. This has certainly been very enjoyable, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to get a lot more people interested in the phenomena itself.
Thanks, guys. It was a real pleasure talking with you, and I enjoyed it very much.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.AboveTopSecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat. We'll be right back.